RIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Protesters march in the U.S. city of Vancouver for the second night to demand justice for yet another black man killed by the police. Georgia is on the verge of a political crisis. The opposition rejects the recent parliamentary poll results claimed by the ruling party. At least seven people are killed as a super typhoon barrels into southern Philippines, bringing intense rains to the region. Good to have you with us. Starting off with the United States, a candlelit vigil in the city of Vancouver for a black man shot dead by police has turned ugly, with rival protesters getting into a brawl. Unrest flared up as mourners were paying tribute to Kevin Peterson Jr. The 21-year-old was killed in a city near Portland, Oregon on Thursday night. Supporters of President Trump, some of them carrying firearms, clashed with a mourning crowd. Windows were also shattered and U.S. flags were burned. Some people in cars used pepper sprays against each other. Federal agents in riot gear arrested at least seven people. The U.S. has been the scene of rallies against racism and police brutalities for several months. The protest began after African-American George Floyd was killed by a white officer in Minneapolis. Data shows a record 90 million Americans have voted early in the presidential election. Concerns about exposure to COVID-19 at busy election day voting places on Tuesday have pushed up the numbers of people voting by mail or at early in-person polling sites. The high number of early voters are about 65% of the total turnout in the election. They say that the coronavirus is their top concern. President Donald Trump and his Democratic rival Joe Biden are campaigning across the nation to try and sway the few remaining undecided voters. Opinion polls show Trump trailing Biden nationally, but with a closer contest in the most competitive states, that'll decide the election. Trump has been harshly criticized for his economic policies and poor handling of the pandemic. Two people have been killed and five wounded in a stabbing attack in the Canadian city of Quebec. According to local police, a sword-wielding suspect dressed in medieval clothing was arrested in the wee hours of Sunday. The suspect was a man in his mid-20s and was transported to the hospital for evaluation. Police asked city residents to stay inside with the doors locked while an investigation was underway. Well, that happened in the historic Old Quebec neighborhood. Police made no comment about a possible motive behind it. Georgia is heading for a political crisis. Opposition parties have rejected the early results of the parliamentary election, showing a narrow lead for the ruling party. The United National Movement of former exiled President Mikhail Saakashvili and smaller parties have joined forces to challenge the outcome. Saakashvili has also accused the ruling Georgian Dream of falsifying election results. Has urged his supporters to stage mass rallies to defend their vote. The Election Commission's tally shows the ruling party leading with over 48%. Against 45% for the opposition. More than 70% of the ballots have been counted. The election held in September will decide 120 of the 150 seats in the national parliament. In the Philippines, authorities are warning of a possibly catastrophic condition. Super Typhoon Goni has hit the region, forcing thousands to flee to safety. The state weather forecaster saying that Goni is the strongest typhoon of the year with a maximum wind speed of 225 kilometers per hour. Several regions are going to experience destructive winds and torrential rainfall over the next day. The storm has taken seven lives, ripping up roofs, uprooting trees, and flooding villages and farmland. Officials say that some 316,000 people have fled to safety. Airport in the capital, Manila, had been closed, and Coast Guard has ordered fishing boats and ferries to return to the port. On an average, 20 typhoons and storms hit the Philippines every year, causing damage to harvest, infrastructure, and homes. The Iranian Air Force will kick off drills on Monday in the central city of Isfahan to display its combat readiness.
These maneuvers are completely offensive in nature and will be conducted independently, featuring only part of the potential and flight capabilities of the Air Force. Units from different air bases will take part. The drills involve a variety of flight equipment, including manned and unmanned aircraft.
Well, the commander added, young pilots will participate in the maneuvers along with more experienced ones in order to hone their skills and put their capabilities to the test. The top general underlined that exercises will also be an opportunity to evaluate Air Force's innovations with regards to the procurement and production of spare parts, improvement of ammunition, and making flight equipment airworthy. He said domestically developed smart munitions as well as a whole range of tactics will be used in the drills. Now, in some other news, many European countries have started implementing tougher restrictions while coronavirus infections continue to surge across the continent. Russia has reported a record high of 18,000 new infections and nearly 250 deaths in a single day. Russia has a total of 1.5 million COVID-19 cases, the fourth highest in the world after the U.S., India, and Brazil. Meantime, the UK, Portugal, France, and Austria have all announced lockdown measures to stem the virus spike. Europe accounts for half of the world's COVID infections, with an average of more than 240,000 cases per day. In our news review program, just a couple hours ago, I've discussed that issue in depth with our guests. Said Europe is a small continent, but accounts for half of the COVID-19 infections. Tell us about where you are now in the UK, how strict those restrictions are, and how people are observing those restrictions.
Good to be with you, Behrouz. Well, we heard over the past 24 hours the UK government come out and announce a new lockdown. It comes after what they refer to as the tiered system, obviously fail in acknowledgement of that failing. But what observers are saying is that the whole of Europe has gone from taking a whack-a-mole strategy game we've all played to a sledgehammer strategy. Whack-a-mole strategy being a tiered system, localized lockdowns of countries such as the UK, France, Germany, and others have tried. That obviously didn't work, and now they went for the so-called, quote-unquote, nuclear option. In the case of the United Kingdom, cases have been rising rapidly recently. There was pressure on the government from certain quarters of power, including the opposition Labour Party, for the government to go with a circuit breaker, which would have meant the announcement of a two-week or three-week national lockdown to curb the fast spread of this very infectious, very deadly virus. They resisted the pressure at the time, but yesterday we heard them come out and actually announce the national lockdown for 4 weeks, which will continue until the 2nd of December. Even so, people are asking, will the government be able to bring the country out of the lockdown at the end of December. But by the 2nd of December, a lot of people are saying that is not probably going to happen. And this morning, Michael Gove, one of the government officials, said that it is possible that the government might extend the one-month national lockdown even further. What is important also to mention is that the spread of the virus depends a lot on people's behavior, as to your question, whether or not people are observing the rules and regulations. I can't speak for everybody or the entire country, but definitely there are people who cannot. I've been watching local television, for example, that yesterday the country was celebrating Halloween, but there was a correspondent in Liverpool, for example, which is in Tier 3, one of the three levels, alert levels, and there were young people and others out there and really not bothered with observing the law, which would have meant, you know, staying at 2 meters apart, wearing their masks and observing social distancing rules. So not everybody is observing the rules announced by the government, and probably that explains why we are looking at a fast rise of infections. As a matter of fact, Imperial College London, just this past week, right in the lead up to this massive announcement, estimated that around 96,000 people were getting COVID-19 every day. Just do the math, and that what would have meant if they hadn't allowed this lockdown by the end of November, Paris.
Exactly. Okay, now let's turn to the Vienna. Homa, tell us what the situation is like there in Austria.
Yes, hello. Well, yesterday we saw an important press conference here in Vienna with the Chancellor, the Health Minister, and the Interior Minister announcing a second lockdown. Now, it's not as strict as the lockdown that we saw in spring, in March, when the rise in infections began in Austria, but it is based on the German model that's been announced in Germany, and it is expected to continue for 4 weeks. Now, this model means that all restaurants and bars and pubs, etc., will be closed. Only shops and those that are needed for essential services will be open. Hotels will be closed. And also schools and kindergartens for now are open, but students above the age of 14 will have to switch to distance learning. So there is it's not as strict as it was before, but the measures are strict in themselves. And we have seen a lot of public resistance to these measures in Austria as well. Just a few days ago, demonstrations were held in the city center here with people saying that they do not want to abide by these restrictions, and themselves not wearing masks, not, as Said was saying, they're observing these public social distancing rules. But there are also another group of people in Austria saying that the government is not taking enough strict measures. So it is a confusing situation for people here. But what the government was saying in the press conference is that the numbers are rising exponentially. So we had, for instance, yesterday, the announcement that more than 5,200 new cases were reported in Austria. And that is five times the number that was announced just 2 weeks before. Right. So this is a situation that the country is concerned that the health authorities cannot cope with, that the intensive care units, the capacity will be reached soon, and then there will be a catastrophe where they say that the health authorities should choose between patients who to save and who to leave, you know?
Right.
So this is a very worrying situation in terms of what the infections are saying.
Yeah, Homa, but compared to other places like France, you're still better off compared to other parts of Europe. Hopefully, authorities and people themselves will try to do something about it and take it seriously and get rid of this disease. Okay, Said, Homa, stay safe, take good care of yourselves. We have to say, Pureza from London and Homa Leski joining us from Vienna. The United States has set a new worldwide record in confirmed COVID-19 cases in a single day. It's reported more than 100,000 new infections. The latest data indicates that the U.S. is recording more than one new case every second. 31 states have also set records for rises in new infections. Friday, more than a dozen states reported their highest one-day coronavirus cases, while 13 states were at record levels of hospitalized patients. More than 9.1 million Americans have been infected by the novel coronavirus. The disease has also claimed more than 230,000 lives in the U.S. Israelis have held fresh demonstrations against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem al-Quds. Protesters gathered outside Netanyahu's residence to condemn his policies and call for his resignation. Scuffles broke out after several people were arrested. The demonstrations came despite a ban. Israelis have staged rallies over the past months to protest soaring unemployment, a hike in COVID-19 infections, and the return of coronavirus restrictions. Adding to anti-regime sentiments are the corruption charges facing the Prime Minister. Netanyahu went on trial in May for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. He denies any wrongdoing, though. Indian-controlled Kashmir has shut down to protest India's amendments and a repeal of its decades-old land law. Well, that has opened up Kashmir land for sale to Indian citizens. Our correspondent has more.
A shutdown is being observed in Indian-controlled Kashmir after New Delhi amended and repealed a series of decades-old land laws of Kashmir. The new reorganization law issued on October 26, 2020, opens up all of Jammu and Kashmir to every Indian citizen and removes every restriction that prevented large land holdings. Allows the Indian armed forces to take over land wherever they desire and gives sweeping powers to the government to take over any land and property for industrial use and bring in big businesses to set up their shops. People's Democratic Party President Mehbooba Mufti, while criticizing the government's move, accused India of land grab for big investors.
We can't sit silent on everything. If the government is so powerful, they should take back land from China, which they grabbed in Ladakh. Since they are not able to take it back from them, they will take our land. It is total lawlessness here.
The October 26, 2020 order repealed 13 state laws and amends 14 laws. Experts say this is to further the agenda behind the abrogation.
The aim is very much, yes, to disempower the Muslim majority of the state of J&K. And in fact, to erase them in history and in culture. I think that that is something that is not a big surprise. The question is how successful they're going to be at doing it, and it's something that only time will tell.
According to historic date check, these laws were introduced to empower the majority Muslims who were suffering immensely under the non-Muslim rulers. Not only this, but the rights to buy and sell land in Kashmir were also confined to the people of Kashmir. Experts say India's move in Kashmir since August 5, 2019 has further internationalized this conflict.
Kashmir is a small blip on the international scenario, you know, but I think that it is gaining salience and it is gaining an advantage. We are gaining an advantage out of it simply. And one of the biggest sort of evidences of that is what happened with the Chinese so-called, not so-called, but actual incursion into Jammu and Kashmir territory in Ladakh.
In response to the shutdown call by Pro-Freedom Camp of Kashmir, shops and businesses remained closed. Huge number of government forces were seen guarding the streets to avoid law and order problems. Almost seven decades ago, these laws were introduced to empower the Muslim majority of Kashmir. But today, when the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party is repealing and amending the same laws, the people of Kashmir are watching over helplessly. Experts say this move clearly depicts India's intentions in Kashmir. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
With that, we come to the end of this broadcast.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense. The very sensitive and outstanding leadership and command of Imam Khomeini.
The second point is that the Sacred Defense was one of the most rational events for the Iranian nation. Some people accuse the people active in the Sacred Defense of lacking insight, citing some mistake made here and there by a group of people. This is not the case in any way. The actions done during the Sacred Defense were intelligent and rational from start to finish. In the beginning, the speeches made by Imam or others indicated the right decision to enter into that arena. After that, we witnessed cooperation between the Guards Corps and the Army. Notice that this is a very important matter. In those days, the army was a traditional and well-established organization in the country, and the Guards Corps was a young newcomer in the revolutionary arena. It was necessary for them to work together, something that was not easy, but it happened.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Of course, when Bani Sadr fled the country, this happened in a better and more complete manner. But it existed before that too. I myself witnessed in Abu Dhar base that the late Shahid Pichak was the second in command to the army commander of that base, whose name I do not remember. A Guards Corps commander was the second in command to an army commander. They would work and live together. In the western part of the country, the Abu Dhar base was a sensitive place as they were in charge of a large section of the war. When the new development took place, Bani Sadr fleeing the country and the Imam undertaking the responsibility to command the armed forces, the cooperation between the army and the Guards Corps became even clearer.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
The United States 2020 presidential election is set to take place in just a few days. Former Vice President Joe Biden, the Democratic Party nominee, faces off against the incumbent Republican President Donald Trump. Is this a real election? Are voters being offered anything substantive? Let's find out. I'm Richard Medhurst in the Communique. Americans are just about to go to the polls and choose their new leader. Out of a population of 320 million, it's all come down to Joe Biden versus Donald Trump. Yes, unfortunately, this is the best that the country can muster. Now, when comparing Donald Trump to Joe Biden, there's a lot to unpack here. Joe Biden has served in government for around 40 years. He was the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, senator for Delaware, and served under Barack Obama as vice president. Donald Trump, on the other hand, doesn't have that long of a record in public service. However, he is the incumbent president. We have 4 years of his tenure to go off of, and he's seeking re-election. Let's start out with their domestic policy. While Joe Biden tries to market himself as middle-class Joe and a friend of the working class, his record says otherwise. He tried multiple times during his tenure in Congress to cut Social Security.
When I argued that we should freeze federal spending, I meant Social Security as well. I meant Medicare and Medicaid. I meant veterans benefits. I meant every single solitary thing in the government. And I not only tried it once, I tried it twice, I tried it a third time, and I tried it a fourth time.
He bragged at one point about working with segregationists. Joe Biden was also an architect of the 1994 crime bill. He pushed the war on drugs, which devastated black and brown communities disproportionately all over America.
We passed a law through the leadership of Senator Thurman and myself and others, a law that says, you're caught with that, you go to jail for 5 years. You get no probation, you get nothing other than 5 years in jail. Judge doesn't have a choice.
Joe Biden's entire career has been spent catering to the fossil fuel industry, to the credit card industry, to the big banks. Remember that he was very supportive of Barack Obama's bailout for Wall Street to the tunes of billions of dollars. Meanwhile, Americans were kicked out of their homes by the millions. Joe Biden was equally a chief architect of the bankruptcy bill in 2005, which left millions of Americans without any protections just as a recession was about to hit, and made sure that students would be lumped with student debt for the rest of their lives. And all of this at the behest of the financial sector, the insurance companies, the credit card companies, the banks. Now, when it comes to Donald Trump, one of the first things that he tried to do once he got into office was repeal the Affordable Care Act and throw millions off of their health care. And then, of course, he gave huge, enormous tax cuts to the rich. Trump completely botched and fumbled the response to COVID-19. Remember, the United States has only 4% of the world's population, yet the highest number of coronavirus cases. Over 200,000 people lost their lives. How does the richest country on earth do such a thing? All of this under his watch, not to mention the corruption by his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, flying in medical equipment from China and selling it off to the highest bidder, even if they're outside the U.S., leaving doctors and nurses without PPE, without the equipment necessary to do their jobs, having to come to work dressed in trash bags. This is corruption pure and simple. And that's the thing. Both of these candidates are corrupt to the core. You could not find worse people to run a country. Moreover, Donald Trump was impeached by the House for obstruction of Congress and abuse of power. Now, given the fact that all U.S. presidents abuse their power and obstruct justice and are corrupt to their cores, that's saying something. Now, internationally speaking, when it comes to foreign policy, what did Joe Biden do? Joe Biden was a staunch supporter of the Iraq War. As a matter of fact, he was an architect of the Iraq War. He was head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He chose all 18 witnesses that would testify in regards to the invasion of Iraq. He gave George Bush all the support that he needed to invade Iraq. And then when he was vice president under Obama's tenure, they ramped it up from 2 wars in Afghanistan and Iraq to 7 wars. When it comes to mass surveillance, this was also handed over by Bush and expanded massively under Obama and Biden's watch. Joe Biden himself and John Kerry were calling up the foreign ministries all over Europe and threatening them not to accept Edward Snowden's asylum request. They canceled his passport on purpose while he was in Russia to make sure that they could smear him as working for the Russian government, even though this is not true. Now, when it comes to Donald Trump, his foreign policy has been to completely undermine international organizations. He pulled out of the World Health Organization. He pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords. He pulled out of the UN Human Rights Council. He went and pulled out of the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. And then afterwards, he went and assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, and Abu Mahdi Mohandes. And then he went and bombed Syria in April 2018 over false pretenses, an alleged gas attack in Douma that never took place. And the OPCW tried to cover this up. The Donald Trump administration also sanctioned the International Criminal Court to try and block their investigation of war crimes in Afghanistan. They went ahead and put these brutal Caesar Act sanctions on Syria that have caused its currency to go into free fall and its economy to collapse. Brutal sanctions on Iran, brutal sanctions on Venezuela trying to steal its gold, trying to enact a coup with Silvercorps, this mercenary group that was sent into Venezuela a few months ago. The coup against Bolivia that ousted Evo Morales and forced him into exile, which was orchestrated by the Organization of American States based in Washington, D.C. And of course, we can't forget the Trump administration's persecution of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, posing the gravest threat to press freedoms worldwide. And of course, when it comes to occupied Palestine, both Joe Biden and Donald Trump have participated, aided, and abetted the oppression and the genocide that is being committed against the Palestinian people by providing the Zionist occupation with billions of dollars in military aid, and Trump even going so far as to recognize Jerusalem as its capital and the occupied Syrian Golan Heights.
I am a Zionist. You don't have to be a Jew to be a Zionist.
Due to the coronavirus pandemic, early voting and voting by mail has been encouraged a lot. As a matter of fact, a record-breaking amount of Americans have already cast their ballots in the election, either by voting early or through mail-in ballots. Now, while voter turnout seems impressive, what we've seen online are countless videos of voters waiting for hours on end in enormous queues just to cast their vote. Is that the sign of a healthy democracy? That's a sign of voter suppression. In a healthy, functioning democracy, you're not supposed to take an entire day just to vote and participate in that democracy. That is actually a very concerning sign, despite what rich white liberals try to say, that this is some mark of resilience, that, oh, look, people are so dedicated to ousting Donald Trump and getting Joe Biden into office that they're willing to wait all day. They shouldn't have to, if America is really a democracy, as we keep on hearing. Why is it particularly the case with voters of color in black and brown communities? People have to wait substantially longer to be able to cast their votes. Why is that the case? Why are less resources invested in those communities? Fewer polling stations, fewer volunteers and personnel. Why are there fewer voting machines? You can't be a democracy when you leave out people of color and prevent them from participating in the elections, in the democratic process. That is voter suppression, pure and simple. Not to mention, we have countless examples of hundreds of polling stations being closed down in Georgia, in Texas, and in a number of other states, preventing people from being able to vote. They might have to work. They might have to drive another hour just to get to a polling station, making it completely inconvenient for anyone who is even contemplating to participate in this democracy. We've had hundreds of thousands of people purged from the voter rolls, the vast majority of them people of color. What does that indicate? What does that say about this country and its so-called democracy? You know, if the United States took all this manpower, took all the resources that it invests in bombing other countries, in colonizing other countries, in occupying other countries, and invested those same resources and manpower and energy and time into its own country, into its own elections, I think it would fare much better. To explore this topic further, I spoke earlier with journalist and political activist Fiorella Isabella. How would you describe the current state of affairs regarding election integrity? Would you describe the election process as fair in the United States?
I'm laughing, Richard, because it's anything but fair. It's a joke. It's a sham. It's absolutely disastrous. And it is a bipartisan practice, meaning both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party cheat. In 2016, they rigged the elections against Bernie Sanders the first time. 2020, we got to follow it up. We literally interviewed poll workers before the election here, and they were telling us the machines were faulty. They were telling us that the training they got was a day's worth of training. The manuals were out of date. The voter rolls were out of date. They also found out, we also found out that these machines have actual access to the internet, and they also have access to SIM cards. So anybody could hack that if you have the code. And we interviewed several election integrity activists and election integrity specialists that showed us exactly how easy it is if you write a code to change those numbers on these machines, because they are all owned by proprietary software, meaning they are private corporations that you know nothing about. So no, the state of our elections is entirely corrupt. And what's happening, unfortunately, right now is that it's still taboo to talk about election issues, right? Like, they still, if you talk about election fraud or say that something is rigged, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. Oh, you must be working for Putin. They love to say that Russia interferes in our elections, that some foreign agent interferes right. in our elections, but they can't for one second even begin to think that we couldn't be interfering in our own elections.
Would you agree that voter suppression is rampant and that it specifically affects voters of color?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and this is, again, it's a bipartisan practice, because in the primaries, the Democrats tend to do that to the people of color. So, for instance, the night before it was the official election day primary, we went to a voting center where it was full of Latino people. It was in East LA. It was full of young people, Latino people, and people of color in general. So the people operating this polling center were giving out provisional ballots. Provisional ballots are this type of pink ballot that needs to be verified multiple times in order to even be counted, and it may never be counted. In fact, most of the time, it's not counted, and it's called a placebo ballot for a lot of people, and that was coined by Greg Palast, because it's a fake ballot. Like, it's not the same thing as a real ballot. And so they were giving these ballots to people because the machines weren't working. So instead of saying, you know what, you should go somewhere else, or we could give you find a way to give you an actual ballot, they just started telling people, this is the same thing, it doesn't matter. And it's not. And so when we started going into the offices and looking at the names that were in these pink ballots, it was all foreign names, all the vast majority Latino names, which of course the Latinos heavily favored the more progressive candidate because of his immigration policy. So that it was just like obvious. And then college campuses where college students go, oh, you got three machines for a college campus of like thousands of people. I mean, that's in California. That's like Democratic supermajority California that this happened. So imagine what happens when Republicans also do the same thing in states like Florida, when they gerrymander and when they're like, no, you have to bring this and put people off the voter rolls. It's a bipartisan practice.
Many progressives who supported Bernie Sanders' campaign have suddenly switched to supporting Joe Biden. They do this in two ways. One, by pushing this narrative, this myth about the lesser of two evils, and simultaneously, by whitewashing Joe Biden's record. This is insulting to everybody who has suffered because of Joe Biden's policies domestically, because of the crime bill, because of mass incarceration, to everybody who suffered because of his war hawk foreign policy, the destruction of Iraq, the millions of people killed and displaced. This is an insult to all of us. You know, we keep hearing this idea of the lesser of two evils, that Joe Biden is somehow the lesser of two evils. To whom? To whom exactly is he the lesser of two evils? To white crypto neoliberals? To black people in America? To people of color in America? He's not the lesser of two evils. He jailed them en masse. To people in the Middle East, to Arabs, to people in Iran, to people all over the global south. This concept does not exist. We are still going to keep getting bombed. We're going to keep getting sanctioned. We're going to keep being killed. We're going to keep being oppressed and colonized, no matter who takes office. And yet we keep hearing this myth about the lesser of two evils. That is such a privileged thing to say that could only emanate from upper middle class white liberals in the United States. To further explore this topic, I spoke earlier with Nico House, broadcast journalist and campaign surrogate for Tulsi Gabbard. We all know that Donald Trump is a racist, he's a loudmouth. Tell me about Joe Biden's record, about his criminal justice, about working with segregationists, about writing the 94 crime bill.
Well, we all should know that Joe Biden is a racist and is also kind of a loudmouth as well. He argued on the Senate floor that he didn't want his kids to go to grow up in a racial jungle, trying to protect segregation on behalf of Republican segregationists. The 94 crime bill is, in my opinion, far more damaging than the average person could possibly know. You can read that bill and tell this was specifically geared to put black people in jail and to basically to auction black lives out to the highest bidder via the private prison system, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, if you learn your history about that situation, it's super weird how it was in lockstep with the corruption of the DEA and the ATF. And there were laws, there were lawsuits regarding that. And then, of course, Clinton fired all the U.S. attorney generals who weren't loyal to him and all the federal judges that weren't loyal to him and put his own people in to the point where we didn't get them out until Trump took over. And so if you actually look at it, it looks like it was a coordinated effort, because it was. As far as Trump is concerned, this is the main difference, in my opinion, between Trump and Joe Biden. People say that those who are okay with another 4 years of Donald Trump are accelerationists, but it's actually the opposite. It's those who are okay with another 4 years of neoliberal Bidenism that is going to end up becoming accelerationists in foreign policy, domestic policy, et cetera, corruption in general, because we just saw how the New York Post was, their article about Hunter Biden was just banned. Before they even had a chance to confirm or deny anything, it was banned. So basically what I'm being told is that I'm allowed to fight one type of fascism, the neo-fascism, but I am not allowed to fight or critique the civility fascist that is Joe Biden.
You know, me as a Syrian, as an Arab, I know that this concept of lesser of two evils is complete nonsense. You know, no matter who gets elected, they're going to keep bombing us, they're going to keep killing us, they're going to keep sanctioning us. So, I mean, you as a black man in America, how do you feel about this myth of lesser of two evils?
They don't keep bombing us, but they do keep, you know, shooting us without accountability. Look at what happened with Breonna Taylor. They don't sanction us like they do maybe Syria, but it is very similar. The banks are still racist. The last case of redlining happened in 2015. This is a Jim Crow policy in 2015. So that's still happening. Ice Cube can't even say that both sides of the establishment are screwing over black Americans. Joe Biden and Donald Trump are equally as bad. The Democratic and Republican parties are equally as bad for us. And we cannot give our vote to anyone anymore without getting something in return. And that is what they were really upset about, is that Ice Cube was doing what a lot of us independent-minded black Americans are doing, which is demanding something for our vote for once in the last 50 to 60 years.
You know, I want to ask you also about Bernie Sanders, about AOC, about the Squad. They all ran on these progressive policies, Medicare for All, Green New Deal, and yet they're telling people to vote for Joe Biden now. What does that say about them? Do you feel that they've been putting their party first, party over policy?
And it's funny because I said yesterday when I saw AOC's comments that she's not just voting for Joe Biden, but she's proudly voting for him. You can't lose my respect. And saying that you're proudly voting for a segregationist, that you're proudly voting for a sex pest, that you are proudly voting for a man who passed the 94 crime bill, obviously was one of the senators that led the way on the Telecommunications Act of 1996, the same man who authored the Patriot Act and brags about how the Patriot Act was his idea, which, by the way, had to work with Kavanaugh to get all the illegal stuff basically circumvented. Like, he went to Kavanaugh to get that squared away, in case anybody was curious. The same man who was anti-LGBTQ until it was convenient for him. The same man who fired the prosecutor in the Ukraine because the prosecutor, or got the prosecutor fired, threatened to hold $1 billion from the Ukrainian government if they did not fire that prosecutor, because that prosecutor was going to investigate Hunter Biden and his influence on Burisma. And then, of course, has just vehemently denied that. I mean, look at all the information that's coming out with Joe Biden. You can proudly vote for him. Or in Bernie's case, oh, not only is he proudly voting for him, but that's his friend. Which, by the way, I hate to say this, but I feel like it should be said. There had to be some very, very latent truth about Hillary's grievances against Bernie as far as saying that he is at least a little sexist in his approach. And unfortunately, the progressive movement has also proven to be the same, because the amount of anger and animosity that I see and I saw, even from Bernie, when he endorsed Hillary, he didn't like her. It was very clear he didn't like her. But with Biden, it's my friend, it's my friend. He was, in the beginning, before Biden started, you know, just trashing him and socialism, he was even enthusiastic about his support for Biden, which we can't really say about his support for Hillary. And you do gotta wonder, what's the difference? Their corruption levels are about the same, except for, I would say that Biden's level of corruption is almost more explicit to a certain degree, or in all the qualities and characteristics that Bernie always assigns to Trump are even more so true, not only in rhetoric, but in policy when it comes to Biden. So what's the difference there? And the only difference that you could think of is really Hillary Clinton's a woman.
You look at also the Obama years when Joe Biden was vice president, you had the Black Lives Matter movement starting out and Occupy Wall Street starting out. So how do we reconcile that? Like, how are we supposed to believe that if Joe Biden is elected, everything is going to somehow magically become better?
Like I said earlier, man, I think you know, the fusion centers, like I was talking about, that's when the local government and police departments work with the NSA and the CIA to target and track activists. Like, a gross overstep of civil liberties. And this is what we're seeing, or what we saw under Obama. The only difference between then and now is that the protests seem to be more widespread. People seem to be more open to the realities of what fascism looks like. And they're willing to challenge it because fascism finally has that ugly caricature of a face that is Donald Trump. But under Biden, the celebrities have been tweeting it out, bro. They've been saying they're ready to stop having to tweet about politics and stop having to pay attention to politics every day. They've been saying. So we know what's going to happen. And meanwhile, people like myself and the Black community, people like you and your relatives and your friends are going to have to just watch bombs drop again in silence.
They're pushing a candidate who does not even support their policies. He does not support universal health care. He does not support a Green New Deal. He does not support any of the progressive platform that Bernie Sanders ran on. Joe Biden is a candidate who cannot even speak properly, who has visible and very concerning signs of cognitive decline.
What kind of country are we going to be? Four more years of George, he's going to find ourselves in a position where if Trump gets elected, we're going to be in a different world.
This shows you how corrupt the Democratic Party is, that they're willing to put forward someone like Joe Biden, who is a right-winger through and through, who cannot even speak properly anymore. And it also shows you how pathetic the progressive wing of the Democratic Party is as well, if they're just willing to roll over and get behind a candidate like Joe Biden. They have become so brazen with this that they're not even trying to hide it anymore. Remember, at the Democratic National Convention, they even invited Colin Powell to speak. Yes, the same Colin Powell who lied to the UN Security Council about weapons of mass destruction that did not exist in Iraq. This attempt to rehabilitate neoconservatives from the Bush era, the fact that Democrats are trying to court George Bush's endorsement, that you have the Lincoln Project, Dick Cheney's daughter, Bill Kristol, Rick Wilson, all getting together to support Joe Biden. This band of disgusting war criminals and neocons speaks volumes. It tells you everything you need to know. There's no such thing as the lesser of two evils. They are the same evil. No matter who you elect, you are going to end up with the same result. And this is a reality that a lot of people just don't want to face. They need to buy into this myth that their elections matter, that America is exceptional, that they have a real democracy, despite all of the evidence to the contrary. United States elections are a farce. They are designed to pacify the population and make them believe that they have a choice, to distract them from the real power structure, from the real actors that are running the show, the intelligence agencies, and Wall Street. The United States constantly talks about democracy, but they don't even have democracy at home. This is a system that is corrupt, unjust, undemocratic, and favors the rich. Donald Trump and Joe Biden are two sides of the same coin. No matter who wins on November 3rd, Black people are still going to get shot. Arabs are still going to be bombed. Natives will still be without their land. Workers will still be exploited. Corporations will be still running the show. The colonization and imperialism and oppression of the global South will continue. In Joe Biden's own words, nothing will fundamentally change. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Salamun alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. Our answers are mostly based on the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri, and we have in our studio the speaker, Brother Mughdad, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Almiya of Qom. Salam alaikum, Brother Mughdad. Thanks for coming to our show.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you to you.
Okay, so let me read the original question that we received a few episodes ago, and we've been talking about it. It reads that we have heard a lot about taqwa and it's important in Islam. I wanted to ask how I can teach my 8-year-old daughter about taqwa. So I'm going to just give a recap, because we've been talking about this question for a few episodes. And just to put you in context, dear listeners, so first of all, we said that taqwa means to remain aware of God and His expectations, subhanahu wa ta'ala. And then we said that taqwa is something that you have to teach in practice, and theory is something that comes later. So you cannot just give the theories and the facts to your child and then expect them to become muttaqi, or people of taqwa. They have to practice it. And Brother Mughdad explained that for them to learn to become people of taqwa, they have to learn to obtain positive traits and characteristics, and that is achieved through habits, learning to be honest and keeping your promises, and also to choose the right role models. At this age, children start creating role models, and we have to be wary that they choose the Ahlul Bayt as their role models. Now, what we explained was that once these two are achieved, children become thirsty for knowledge and for knowing. They'll start asking questions about God, subhanahu wa ta'ala. Who's God? Who are the Ahlul Bayt? Why is honesty good? And this is where the theory starts to kick in, and we start to explain to our children about the theories that lead to a person becoming muttaqi. I took 2 minutes of the time that we had. You have 2 minutes to give us a short summary about the last topic that we talked about, which was role models, so that we can then start talking about the third aspect, which is knowledge.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we said that what happens is that when you have the right model, right role model, and you've gained this, you've grown on a very fertile land where you've got good habits, your inclinations and your likes and dislikes are based on this role model that's the ultimate perfect human being. Slowly, you now, this child now asks questions. This child wants to learn and wants to understand things. And this is a fundamental stage where parents have to ensure that very gradually they start to open the doors of knowledge for these children. That is not to bombard them with so much information, but that's rather to guide them towards a journey of learning, right? So whether it's through books, whether it's through sending them to madrasa and to school, to get them to be acquainted with a teacher, for example, different ways that we've either talked about before or we can talk about in the future. But somehow, through this journey of knowledge, let them understand the principles of Islam, right? And this is mainly based on three things. So one is the fundamental values, fundamental beliefs of Islam. So questions related to God, questions related to the Ahlul Bayt, through guidance, through what is the human being, etc. Second is to relate to with morality, the traits that one has to acquire, things like generosity, things like kindness, things like respecting others, things like tolerance. These are things that children want to understand why we should be doing this, why should we acting in this way, why should we gaining these traits. And lastly is through the rituals, but I don't like this word too much, but you could say the rituals, basically the prayer and the fasting, how to pray, how to fast, what are the things that I have to do as a sign of obedience to Allah in the practical aspect and the actions, the physical actions that I do.
Okay, let's take a break now, and after the break we'll be back for more discussions on this topic. Don't go away.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio at irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic upbringing. We're talking about how to teach our children about taqwa. So we said that once the fertile ground has been prepared for them to accept the knowledge and the theories related to taqwa, that's when we start explaining to them, but we have to be wary not to bombard them with information and overwhelm them with too much.
So once they're slowly gaining this knowledge, at the same time they're applying this knowledge, right? So they're learning, for example, how to pray, and at the same time they're praying. They're learning how to be honest and the importance of knowledge, and they're being honest. They're learning about the importance of saying thank you to Allah and reciting ziyarat of the Ahlul Bayt, and they're applying that as well. So as they're learning and they're applying their learning, okay, and this is now we're growing older now, right? We're looking at 13, 14, 15 slowly. I'm just giving you a whole journey so we're aware of it, right? What happens is slowly, motivations of a human being start changing, right? And this is where we talk about the three fundamental levels of taqwa, right? So the first motivation that comes up is, one of the first motivations that comes up is that we do things because we want the positive consequences of our actions in the hereafter,